Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai escapes from the downfall of Jerusalem by pretending to be dead. The future rebirth of rabbinic Judaism is born out of Jerusalem on a coffin. Life and death inextricably bound up with one another. Around 2 years ago, a congregant of mine was married in Miami. This young man is of Sephardic descent. He was born and raised in Madrid and was a descendant of the Sephardic community that for centuries had made their home in Morocco. And before the wedding, the groom's father reached out to me and explained that the Jews that traced their origins to Castile have a special ketubah that is utilized at their weddings. And at the chuppah, according to their tradition, this document was not merely read, but sung in a special tune. So I studied the text, I learned the tune, and I was called to sing the Ketubah of Castile before hundreds of people, and I nailed it. Now the Ketubah concludes with the following words, V'akol kefi ha-minhag v'atnai, shenagu v'shiitkinu kilot ha-kodesh, ha-migurashot mi-kastia. All of this wedding has been performed according to the traditions and the laws of the holy community that has been exiled from Castile. Hashem yishmor nishmatam, may God keep their soul safe, v'yachon v'yirachem al sheirit pleitatam, and bestow grace and mercy on the remnant of their exiles. And as I stood there singing this ketubah, I thought to myself, here we are today, celebrating a Jewish marriage, marking a joyous moment, using the same tunes and the same words of the exiles of 1492. In that year, the year of the expulsion, the ancestors of this groom remain loyal to their faith, and in an expulsion that concluded on or around the 9th of Av, they embarked on a perilous journey into an Eretz Lo Zuru'ah, what was for them an unsown land. And there I was, in the 21st century, standing under the chuppah, singing the same ketubah. Spanish Empire was no more, yet there are still descendants of those Jews reading the Castilian ketubah under wedding canopies today. And I was overcome with a sense of the Jewish ability to rise phoenix-like from the ashes, to resurrect itself after the most destructive moments in its history. If there's any man whose life story embodies the Jewish capacity for resurrection, it is the one on whom we focus today, Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who escapes Jerusalem right before it is destroyed by Vespasian's armies, and who oversees the academy at Yavneh, where his five students set the stage for the next two millennia of Torah. Rabbi Yochanan's greatness can be seen from chapter 2 of Avot, where he is the only non-descendant of Hillel, who is accorded the patriarchal title, Rabban. He is for our faith nothing less than the savior of Judaism and the founding father of Torah learning and law in the post-temple period. But rightly understood, he is even greater than that. And careful reading of Avot allows us to understand that Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai was an educational pioneer. And one maxim in this chapter may perhaps allow us to understand that the greatest moment in his life involved not something that he did, but something that he did not do. And the choice that he made in that moment helped define the future of Judaism forever. Let us begin with Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai's Mishnah Navot, where he is associated with a seemingly simple statement. There is, however, a question in manuscripts as to one word, and this etymological issue is intriguing. Many printed texts today, including the one you have before you, give us his maxim as follows. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai kibel mihilel mishamai, hu haya omer, im lamata Torah harbe, al tachzik tova la'atzmacha ki lekach notzarta. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai used to say, if you have learned much Torah, take no special credit for yourself, for it was for this purpose that you were created. In most early versions of Avot, however, the statement is not im lamata Torah harbe, if you learn much Torah, but rather im asita Torah harbe, if you have made much Torah. Such language is, at least superficially, somewhat strange, which is why many printed versions today don't have it. Jews learn Torah. They do not make Torah. Or do they? The verb imasita, if you have made, is very possibly the original version. And it is this interesting choice of word, this one word, that has inspired most of my thinking about Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And we will turn to the meaning of imasita later in the lecture. Meanwhile, let us turn to the next Mishnah in the chapter. Chamisha tamidim hayu l'Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai ve'elu hein, Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkanus, Rabbi Yeshua ben Chananya, Rabbi Yosi HaKohen, Rabbi Shimon ben Netanel, Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had 5 disciples, Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Yosi, Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Elazar ben Arach. Hu hayam monesh vacham. He used to recount their praise. Eliezer ben Hurkanus bor sud sheino ma'abetipa. Eliezer ben Hurkanus is a plastered well that never loses a drop. Yoshua ben Chananya, ashrei olato. Yoshua ben Chananya, happy is the one who gave birth to him. Yosi HaKohen chasid. Yosi HaKohen is a pious man. Shimon ben Netanel yirechet. Shimon ben Netanel is a man who fears sin. Elazar ben Arach, k'mayan hamitkaber. Elazar ben Arach is an ever-flowing spring. This is another statement affiliated with Aben Yochanan ben Zakkai. And it stands out because it seems incongruent with the genre of Avot. Most Mishnayot in the tractate, as we have seen, provide us with a maxim, which is in turn a window into the worldview of the man behind the maxim. At first blush, in this Mishnah, what Rabbi Yochanan gives us is not a maxim at all. It is a piece of explicit biography, utterly unlike the Mishnayot of any other sage. But rightly understood, what is being given here is actually a spiritual and moral maxim, because it provides perspective on who Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai truly was. Rabbi Jonathan Sachs puts it this way. He writes, the Mishnah is doing more than telling us that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had disciples. Every rabbi had disciples. The imperative, raise up many disciples, is one of the oldest rabbinic teachings on record. What the Mishnah is telling us, he writes, is how to create disciples. It is easy to have students who are uncritical devotees, but never become creative intellects in their own right. It is not difficult to create followers. It is far harder to create leaders. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai was a great teacher because 5 of his students became giants in their own right. The Mishnah is telling us how he did it. He showed each of his pupils where their particular strength lay. Eliezer ben Hurkanus, the plastered well that never loses a drop, was gifted with a superb memory, an important gift in an age in which manuscripts were rare and the oral law was not yet committed to writing. Shimon ben Netanel, the man who fears sin, may not have had the intellectual brilliance of the others, but his reverential nature was a reminder to others that they were not mere scholars, but also holy men engaged in a sacred task. And Elazar ben Arach, the ever-flowing spring, had a creative mind constantly giving rise to new interpretations of ancient texts. End quote. So understood this way, much as the maxims in each Mishnah exist to provide a window into the life and the worldview of the man uttering that maxim, this Mishnah is not here first and foremost to tell us about these 5 disciples, but also, if not primarily, to teach us about the educational philosophy of Rabbi Yochanan, who sought to bring the unique gifts of each of his pupils to the fore. Rabbi Yochanan thus emerges as a man and a teacher and a leader who bequeaths us a psychological insight that the world today is only beginning to appreciate. University of Pennsylvania's Martin Seligman is one of the pioneering founders of the field known as positive psychology. And in one well-known story, he describes how he hit upon an insight that created the movement for which he is known. He writes, I was in my garden with my 5-year-old daughter, Nikki. And to make another confession, he writes, even though I've written a book about children and have worked with children, I'm no good with them since I'm time-urgent and task-oriented. I was weeding in the garden. And Nikki was throwing weeds into the air, dancing, singing, and having a wonderful time. And I shouted at her. She walked away puzzled and walked back and said, Daddy, I want to talk to you. And I said, yeah, Nikki. And she said, Daddy, do you remember before my 5th birthday, she had turned 5 about 2 weeks before, do you remember I was a whiner, that I whined every day? And I said, yeah, I remember. You were a horror. And she said, have you noticed since my 5th birthday, Daddy, I haven't whined once? Yeah, Nikki. And then she said, Daddy, on my 5th birthday, I decided I wasn't going to whine anymore. And that was the hardest thing I've ever done. And if I can stop whining, you can stop being such a grouch. At that moment, Seligman writes, he realized three things. First, that he had failed as a person. I realized, he wrote, that Nikki was right about me, that I had spent more than 50 years being a nimbus cloud. So I resolved to change. Second, he realized that he had failed as a parent. I realized, he wrote, that my theories of child rearing were wrong. The theories of child rearing that the last two generations have been raised with in psychology are remedial. They basically say the job of the parent is to correct the kid's errors, and somehow out of the corrections of errors, an exemplary child rises. That led, Seligman continues, to the third, final, and most important epiphany, that he and his colleagues had failed as psychologists, because what's true for children is also true for adults. Psychology had, from Freud onward, been remedial, merely about correcting flaws in human beings, and not about making manifest their talents, their gifts, their positive traits. He writes, I realized that with any program whose aim is to correct what's wrong, the best it can ever get to is zero. And yet when you lie in bed at night, you're not thinking about how to go from -5 to -2. You're generally thinking about how to go from +2 to +6 in life. It became my mission in life, he writes, from that moment in the garden, to help to create a positive psychology, a psychology focusing not only on doing away with the negative, but also in encouraging individuals to make manifest their positive traits, to become the strongest individuals that they can be, end quote. This is the educational approach of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, and it allows further insight into the adverb in most versions of Avot. Not if you have learned much Torah, but if you have made much Torah. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's goal is not only learning Torah or even teaching Torah, it is making Torah, creating Torah. If the mantra of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah is Hamidu Talmidim Harbeh, if the council's response to a crisis, that crisis is an age in which revelation has ceased, is to allow human difference to reveal new insights in the Torah, then Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's response to an even greater crisis, the destruction of the temple, is to not only establish many students, but to also allow their unique qualities to make themselves manifest, which will in turn produce an age of Torah, the likes of which Jerusalem in the Second Temple period in all its glory may not have seen. And it is this educational philosophy which is what turns a yeshiva in a backwater in the land of Israel into, to use a phrase from Bialik, the Beit HaYotzer L'Nishmat HaUmah, the smithy in which the steely soul of the Jew is forged. And it is this approach, pioneered in Yavne, which allows Judaism to not only endure, but flourish for 2,000 years of exile. Avot, then, is presenting us with a man who is a pedagogical pioneer. And as we further study the Mishnayot in this chapter associated with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, we see that while he celebrates the virtues of all of his students, nevertheless, there are two whose gifts are prized by him above all. And this is the next Mishnah. Hu haya omer, im yu kol chachmei Yisrael bakaf moznayim ve'eliezer ben Hurkanus bakaf shniyah machriyat kulam. Abba Shaul omer mishmo, im yu kol chachmei Yisrael bakaf moznayim ve'eliezer ben Hurkanus af imahem. He used to say, if all the sages of Israel were on one side of the scale, and Eliezer ben Hyrcanus on the other, he, Eliezer, would outweigh them all. However, Abba Shaul said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, that if all the sages of Israel, including Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, were on one side of the scale, and Eliezer ben Arach was on the other, then he, Eliezer ben Arach, would outweigh them all. This Mishnah, when you think about it, is actually a bit amusing, perhaps intentionally so. Probably not, but it is a bit amusing. We have two versions of what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai actually said. And the central question in this Mishnah is which intellectual gift he prized most highly. Rabbi Eliezer, as we know, had a photographic memory. He is the plastered cistern that never loses a drop. Rabbi Elazar ben Arach is creative. He is the ever-flowing spring. For Rabbi Yochanan, which is more important, creativity or memory? Answer? We don't remember for sure. According to one version, Eliezer ben Hyrcanus is the greatest sage. According to another, according to Abba Shaul's version, it is Eliezer ben Arach who is the greatest. But it's one of the two. What this means is that while Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai highlighted his students' unique gifts, he may actually have incorrectly predicted which of his disciples would emerge as the most influential, because it was neither of these two. As Rabbi Sachs notes further, tragically, Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus was eventually excommunicated by his colleagues, as we'll discuss this afternoon, for failing to accept the majority view on a matter of Jewish law. As for Rabbi Eliezer ben Arach, he became separated from his colleagues, When they went to the academy at Yavne, he went to Emmaus, a pleasant place to live, but lacking in other Torah scholars. Eventually, he forgot his learning and became a pale shadow of his former self. Now, why did these students not fulfill Rabbi Yochanan's expectations, if intellectually they far surpassed the others? The ultimate lesson is that rabbinic greatness lies in much more than intellectual brilliance. Now, let me emphasize, intellectual ability is essential. You cannot become a Torah giant if you are not intellectually gifted. But ability will only allow one to become a Talmid Chacham or even a brilliant scholar, but it will not make him into a rabbinic leader. What is required is the ability to build upon the Torah knowledge that one has acquired and then impact others. In the end, as we shall see in our final lecture, it will be Rabbi Yochanan's student, Rabbi Yoshua ben Hananya, who will emerge as the central intellectual force and the methodological and theological leader of Yavne. And when we look to the words of praise that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has for Rabbi Yoshua, they are initially ambiguous. It is not quite clear what he means. Every other virtue he describes is understandable: creativity, memory, fear of sin. But then we have this, Yoshua ben Hananya, Ashrei Yolato. Yoshua ben Hananya, fortunate is the one who gave birth to him. What does that mean? What praise is that of Rabbi Yoshua? Rabbi Ben Ilau, I believe, has an excellent explanation, noting a nugget of information from the Jerusalem Talmud that Yoshua's mother used to bring his cradle to the Beit Knesset, to the synagogue, so that his ears would cleave to the words of Torah. From womb to birth, he writes, and from cradling to swaddling, Rabbi Yoshua grew up immersed in Torah. He was a child of the Beit Midrash, end quote. That means that the society of scholars was one in which Yoshua was the most comfortable. He was a creature of that community, not only in terms of intellect, but in terms of what we call in the yeshiva, a chevreshaft. That's the technical term. The creation of friendship through the forging of intellectual bonds. In the next Mishnah in Avot, where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked each one of his students to choose the proper path to which one should cleave, Rabbi Yoshua chooses chaver tov, a good companion. In Ben Ilau's words, in the world of the Beit Midrash, individual creativity cannot be divorced from that of the community. Torah scholars shape and sharpen one another like pieces of iron. Those who sit alone quickly grow dull. And he adds, Rabbi Yoshua was born into the Beit Midrash and never left this milieu. We hardly ever, in rabbinic writings, find him alone. Either he is walking alongside his teacher, or else he is accompanied by his students. And, as we shall see in the next lecture, Rabbi Yoshua will famously issue the statement, Acharei Rabim Lahatot, let the view of the many decide. Rabbi Yoshua, writes Lau, embodied the vibrant society of the sages and the pluralism of the Talmudic community, end quote. Understood this way, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai issues the statement, Ashrei Yolato, about Rabbi Yoshua, he is, to use a modern term, praising Rabbi Yoshua's emotional intelligence. But even Rabbi Yochanan may not have known how important this skill would be to the future of rabbinic Judaism. Looking back on the 20th century, I can think of several scholars who, in terms of raw intelligence, either in their creative capacities as ever-flowing springs, or as men of phenomenal memory, as plastered cisterns that did not lose a drop, these scholars were intellectually yichidim bidoram, unique in their generation. But nevertheless, these men did not emerge as the greatest and most influential rabbinic leaders of their age. They did not define the future of Judaism because they did not have this other emotional capacity that Rabbi Yoshua was blessed with. And so ultimately, it is not Rabbi Eliezer or Elazar ben Arach, but rather Rabbi Yoshua that will emerge as Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's most important student. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai then was truly one who was Oseh Torah Harbe, who made much Torah, who not only raised up many students, but actually made them, created them, brought their unique capacities to the fore, bringing forth a dazzling array of intellectual and emotional virtues in Yavne that, under this great teacher, defined the future of Judaism forever. Now that we have some sense of what he achieved, we can now proceed to uncover another element of his greatness, one which I think is often overlooked, but which actually may be the most remarkable aspect of his biography. Here we turn to the Talmud's famous tale of Rabbi Yochanan fleeing Jerusalem, right before it was destroyed. Rabbi Yochanan's nephew, we are informed by the Talmud, was one of the factions of Jews within Jerusalem, which was a city beset by civil war within, even as it was fighting the Romans besieging Jerusalem without. After this infighting resulted in the destruction of Jerusalem's food supply, Yochanan ben Zakkai realized that the city was doomed and sought to leave to create a haven for Torah scholars before Jerusalem actually fell. And we are told in the Talmud and Gittin, this is 56a, that he sent, that we are told that Rabbi Yochanan had a nephew who was a leader of one of the factions, and he contacted him and asked him for help in sneaking out of the city. Romans were besieging the city outside, but in order to keep the Jews inside and to ensure that they did not surrender, the factions in Jerusalem, the Jewish factions, were not allowing anyone to leave either. So he sought help in escaping. I'll read largely from the translation, one translation, but refer back at times to the Hebrew and Aramaic. So Rabbi Yochanan sent to him, to his nephew, saying, "Come to visit me privately." When he came, he said to him, "How long are you going to carry on in this way and kill all the people with starvation?" Rabbi Yochanan's nephew replied, "What can I do? If I say any word to them," meaning to the factions, "they will kill me." Said Rabbi Yochanan, "Devise some plan for me to escape. Perhaps I shall be able to save a little." And so his nephew said to Rabbi Yochanan, "Pretend to be ill and let everyone come to inquire about you," meaning spread rumors that you're sick. "Then bring something that smells evil and put it by you so that they will say that you are dead. Let then your disciples get under your bed, but no others, so that they will not notice that you are still light, since they know that a living being is lighter than a corpse." This means that your disciples should carry you on your deathbed or your coffin. Your body will be covered. You will be alive. Only your students will know that you are still alive. And then they will allow you to leave because they will assume that you are a corpse. And so he was borne out of the city. And according to the Talmud, in its description, the coffin was taken with Rabbi Eliezer, his student from one side, and Rabbi Yoshua, his other student, from the other. Now, let us just pause to note one interesting fact. This is the version of the story in the Babylonian Talmud. In another rabbinic version of the story, in Avot de Rabbi Natan, Rabbi Eliezer is standing at Yochanan's head bearing the coffin, and Rabbi Yoshua is bearing the other end from the feet. Rather than being on the two sides, we have Rabbi Eliezer at the head and Rabbi Yoshua at his feet. And based on what we now know in our descriptions of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's students, this image is a profound one. Rabbi Eliezer, with his photographic memory, he is the plastered cistern that never loses a drop, he stands at the head of his teacher. He has, as it were, the mind of Rabbi Yochanan. All of Rabbi Yochanan's information is downloaded from that magnificent mind into his magnificent mind. But the feet of Rabbi Yochanan are held by Rabbi Yoshua, because ultimately the future progress of Judaism lies not with Rabbi Eliezer, but with Rabbi Yoshua. Now let us continue onward with the story. Kimatu lepitcha, when they reached the gate of Jerusalem, ba'u lemitkere, some of the men guarding Jerusalem from within wanted to stick a spear into him to ensure that he was actually dead. Amar lehu, so one of those bearing Rabbi Yochanan said to the guard, "Yomru Rabban Dakru, do you want people to say, do you want the Romans to say they have stabbed their master?" I mean, that the Jews stabbed their rabbis. Then, Ba'u Lemidchafe, they wanted to instead push him to see if he was still alive. Amrlhu, again, they said to the guard, "Yomru Rabban Dakfu, do you want the Romans to say that they pushed their master?" And so, Patchule Lepitcha, Patchule Baba Nafak. They opened the gate for them to leave, and they were allowed to leave. Now again, we have to pause for a moment in order to ponder this image. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai escapes from the downfall of Jerusalem by pretending to be dead. The future rebirth of Rabbinic Judaism is born out of Jerusalem on a coffin. Life and death inextricably bound up with one another. One of the most enduring scenes in American literature is the end of Moby Dick, in which Ishmael the sailor last surviving member of the crew of the doomed and destroyed Pequod, flounders in the stormy sea until he suddenly grasps hold of a floating box that allows him to survive until his rescue. And this box, it is revealed at the end of the book, was a coffin from the ship's hold, and it is this embodiment of death that bears him to life. It is Rabbi Norman Lamb who noted that this image in Melville has a Talmudic forebear, our tale of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, in which, exquisitely aware of the fact that Jerusalem is doomed, he is smuggled out of the besieged city in a coffin so that he can found the yeshiva in Yavneh. He is pretending to be dead so that Judaism can live on. The metaphor is pregnant with possible interpretations. First, most simply, there is the constant death and ultimate rebirth of Judaism itself that this moment embodies, or rather, the constant seeming death and ultimate rebirth of Judaism itself. Second, and this interpretation builds on the first, the meaning here may be that if Rabbi Yochanan laid the foundations for the Jewish future, it is because he was motivated and moved by the deaths of those he was leaving behind, by the obligation to preserve the memory of what had been lost, so it could one day return. It is, as Lincoln said at Gettysburg, it is for us the living to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. In a similar sense, what bore Judaism on its path to life is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's experiencing the deaths of those remaining in Jerusalem, and an awareness that it was through the future that the sacrifices of those he was leaving behind would be given meaning. And indeed, one of the extraordinary aspects of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's leadership is that even as he was founding Rabbinic Judaism anew, without a temple in Yavneh, he ordained a number of new rules in order to allow us to remember the temple, along with the mantra that we do these actions because Mehira Yibaneh Beit HaMikdash, speedily may the temple be rebuilt, and we will need to remember what once was, so we can do it again. Or as Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik once put it in Yiddish, Hatiyal Rabbi Yechanan ben Zakkai's, Vasen Misakin Gevent HaKonas Lezecher Beis HaMikdash, Afen Morgen von Chorben Beis HaMikdash, that the rebirth of Judaism is embodied through people like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who ordained ordinances in memory of the temple the morning after the destruction of the temple. So this too is another meaning in the coffin, death leading to life, death inspiring life. And there is a third possibility, one put forward by Ruth Weiss, which is that in this story, Yochanan ben Zakkai, as she writes, had to acquiesce to defeat in order to get beyond it. And perhaps, she notes, the coffin story is there to suggest that he, Yochanan, died as one kind of Jew in order to reemerge as another. Sovereignty of Jerusalem is given up on temporarily so that Judaism, in another form, can survive. Be that as it may, the coffin story emphasizes Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's ability to create life out of death and to achieve nothing less than the resurrection of Judaism. Let us continue our tale. When Yochanan reaches the Romans, he said to Vespasian, "Peace to you, O king. Peace to you, O king." He greeted Vespasian, the general besieging Jerusalem, as an emperor. Vespasian replied, "Your life is forfeit, because, one, I am not a king, and you call me a king. And, even if I am a king, then why didn't you come to see me before?" And Yochanan ben Zakkai replies, "As for your saying that you are not a king, in truth you are a king, since if you were not a king, Jerusalem would not be delivered into your hand." And it is at this point, according to the Talmud, that a messenger comes to him from Rome and says, "Arise, for the emperor is dead and the notables of Rome have decided to make you, Vespasian, the new head of state." Vespasian is impressed at Rabbi Yochanan's prediction, and he offers to grant Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai whatever he wishes. At this moment, according to the Babylonian Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan expresses three requests. Amar leh, he says to Vespasian, "Tain li Yavna v'chachamel." Give me Yavna and its sages, meaning allow me to establish this academy. "Vishushilta de Rabban Gamliel." Allow me to preserve the dynasty of Rabban Gamliel, meaning allow the Nasiet, the patriarchy, the dynasty of Hillel, to be preserved as the political and religious leadership of the Jewish people. Hasfata de Messiah le Rabbi Tzadok. And please provide medical attention for Rabbi Tzadok, who had been fasting and was in urgent need of medical care. These are his three requests. Now the Talmud adds the following. Rabbi Joseph, or some say Rabbi Akiva, applied the following verse to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. God turns wise men backwards and makes their knowledge foolish. Meaning that in the view of this rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai acted wrongly. Why? Because upon being granted seemingly any request by Vespasian, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai should have asked the general to spare Jerusalem. However, says the Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did not ask for this because he believed that this much Vespasian would not grant. And so even a Hatzalah Purta, a bit of a salvation, would not occur. This is the exchange in the Talmud. And it's interesting to note that at least according to one version, it is Rabbi Akiva, the great Rabbi Akiva in the future, who is expressing this criticism of Rabbi Yochanan. And if it is Rabbi Akiva who expresses this criticism of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, it is because Rabbi Akiva is the great optimist of Talmudic tales. And so he believes that standing before Vespasian, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai should have gone for broke and asked for the salvation of Jerusalem. What we have then in this tale is Rabbi Akiva the optimist and Rabbi Yochanan the realist. The former saw the Roman military onslaught as a temporary setback and found in Vespasian's offer a providential opportunity to save the temple. The latter, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, was certain that nothing could prevent the Romans from ravaging Jerusalem, whereas Rabbi Akiva would have gone for broke. The latter, believing that tragedy was imminent, attempted to save what he could. We do not know for sure whether Rabbi Yochanan ever regretted his decision, but a clue can be found in the story of his death, a moving tale that is described in Brachot, Tractate Brachot, 28a. And this story is the following. When Rabbi Yochanan lay dying, his disciples came to visit him. Seeing them, he began to cry. And they said to him, Light of Israel, Pillar of Torah, Patish HaChazak, O strong, mighty hammer, Mipnei Ma Ata Bocha, why do you cry? And he replied, If I were being taken before a king of flesh and blood, who is here today and in the grave tomorrow, whose anger is not permanent, and who cannot permanently destroy me, even so I would weep. Now I am being taken before Melech Malchei HaMelachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu, before the Supreme King of Kings, who lives and endures forever, whose anger, if he is angry with me, is an everlasting anger, who, if he imprisons me forever, who, if he puts me to death, puts me to death forever, and whom I cannot persuade with words or bribe with money. And even more so, he adds, now there are two paths open before me, one leading to paradise and one to hell, and I do not know by which of them they are taking me. Should I not weep? That is the statement. And commentators on this passage have had difficulty with the premise that a sage as righteous as Rabbi Yochanan would have so much to fear in facing his maker. Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, however, has suggested that Rabbi Yochanan was thinking back to this day when Vespasian offered to grant him any request. Rabbi Yochanan believed that he was saving Judaism, but perhaps on his deathbed he wondered whether this was true and whether Rabbi Akiva was right after all. Had he read Vespasian correctly? Could he have asked for more? Indeed, could he have prevented the exile altogether? As Rabbi Soloveitchik writes, who at the time could foresee how Vespasian would reject so enormous a request as the sparing of Jerusalem? This difficult decision, perhaps the most difficult question in Jewish history, Rabbi Yochanan had to decide by himself without consultation with colleagues in a fleeting moment. He was therefore never certain that he had decided correctly. On the one hand, it appeared to him that he could have influenced Vespasian to spare Jerusalem, as Rabbi Akiva thought, and his heart bled at not having asked for it. On the other hand, he thought it was forbidden to place in possible danger the lives of the sages of Yavne and the oral law. Notwithstanding the sanctity and the importance of the temple, writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, national existence is not dependent on it. However, without the oral law, the Jewish people would not continue to exist. How many restless nights and sorrow-filled days, writes Rabbi Soloveitchik, ensued for Rabbi Yochanan because of this doubt? We cannot even imagine it. Thus it was that in the last moment of his life, there were two paths, one correct, the other not correct, one leading to paradise and the other leading to hell. In other words, Rabbi Yochanan was tormented by the question of whether he would be remembered as Judaism's Churchill or its Chamberlain. Today, however, he is revered as the former. It's just an FYI. Thus, if it is Rabbi Yochanan rather than Rabbi Akiva who became the father of rabbinic Judaism, it is because Rabbi Yochanan believed that in times of great crisis, optimism alone is not sufficient. Martin Seligman himself, who wrote an entire book on optimism, puts it this way. In many arenas of life, optimism is unwarranted. At times we do fail irretrievably, and seeing those times through rose-colored glasses may console us but will not change them. In some situations, the cockpit of an airliner, for example, what's needed is not an upbeat view but a mercilessly realistic one. Sometimes we need to cut our losses and invest elsewhere rather than find reasons to hold on. So the realist, to reuse Ruth Weiss's metaphor, is willing to die in order to live. It took the positive thinking of Rabbi Akiva to help the Jews keep hope alive and to continue to believe that the ultimate redemption was still certain. But it took the realism of Rabbi Yochanan to prepare for the long, hard centuries in the meantime. The survival of the Jewish people without Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is not conceivable. And yet lying on his bed, the savior of Judaism makes manifest not arrogance, but humility. He has done his best with the challenges handed to him by history. He is uncertain if everything he chose was correct, but he did as best as he could in the conundrum that he was asked to confront by God. That for him is all. What emerges of the personality of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is of a man who is both visionary and realist, recreator of Judaism in continuity with the past, and most astonishingly, a rabbinic leader who is nothing less than the savior of Judaism, the father of post-Temple Judaism, the man who is caretaker to Judaism's seeming death and its rebirth, who lies on his own deathbed without a scintilla of hubris, with nothing but the prayer that he has played his role in history correctly, and that he has done what he can in order to allow Judaism to endure. And it is this lack of arrogance that allows us to uncover Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's most astonishing act. Of the three requests from Rabbi Yochanan to Vespasian, the most famous is Tein li Yavne v'chachamea, give me Yavne. But in light of all that he has accomplished, even more interesting is perhaps his second request, preserve the dynasty of Rabban Gamliel, of Hillel. The one man who was not Hillel's descendant to attain the title of Rabban, Yochanan ben Zakkai, gave no thought to founding a new dynasty of his own or to supplanting the Hillelian dynasty. Seeing that leadership, that of the Nasi, that of the descendants of Hillel, as the source of the unity of Jewry of the Holy Land, he asked Vespasian not only for Yavne, but also for the dynasty to be saved. And it would seem, based on Talmudic sources, that when ultimately, after the destruction, Rabban Gamliel made his way from Jerusalem to Yavne, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai just stepped aside and went to a location known as Bror Chayil, meaning the man who had saved Israel humbly stepped off the historical scene, a Jewish version of John Trumbull's painting in the Capitol in Washington, of Washington resigning his commission and returning to Mount Vernon. Herein lies a lesson. Statesmen, leaders, great men of history are usually remembered for what they achieved. Yet often their greatest moments are best understood by what they chose not to do. We speak of George Washington as the father of our country, and we recall in that context what he accomplished, expelling the British from Boston, crossing the Delaware, conquering Cornwallis at Yorktown, leading the Constitutional Convention, first president of the United States. Yet, it may well be that these achievements pale in comparison to Washington's decision not to seize power and to resign his commission once victory over the British had been secured. In today's democratic age, we take that moment for granted. But Washington's resignation was best understood by his enemy, George III. If he does that, said the monarch, he will be the greatest man in the world. Similarly, Menachem Begin is remembered for what he did, the Osirak strike, peace with Egypt, leading a rebellion against the British. But it was what Begin did on the Altalena, or rather what he asked his fellow Jews not to do, not to kill other Jews, even when those Jews were the ones doing the shooting at them. It is that choice of what not to do that will ensure Begin's immortality. That defined the nascent state of Israel. That's what actually helped form it into a country. That is what prevented civil war. Similarly, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai created Yavne, but is choosing to step back and allow all that he had created to go under the authority of the Nasi. That is an astonishing act of humility that defined Judaism to this day. And though, as we have seen in previous lectures, the Nasi's arrival at Yavna was at first a source of dissension, it was soon after, as we have also seen, that the man who combined the Torah of Rav Yochanan and the authority of the Hillelian dynasty, Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, it was he who was able to create the Mishnah and ensure our eternity as we were exiled all over the world. And it is with this in mind that we can now better appreciate the extraordinary meaning of what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is saying in his maxim in what is for most manuscripts the original version. Imasita Torah harbeh, al tachzik tova la'atzmecha. If you have made, crafted, created much Torah, do not be arrogant, because for this purpose you were created. This is not a statement, first and foremost, for everyone. Rather, this is a statement for himself, to himself, about himself. All Torah imbibed from Yavna till today comes from Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He made all of it. Had anyone had the right to bestow new honor and authority upon himself as the savior of Judaism, or make himself Nasi for life, it could have been him. But no, he served his role, one of the most important in Jewish history, without hubris, and the seemingly simple maxim with which he left us is actually one of the most eloquent testimonies to his greatness. This past year, on the way back from marking my son's bar mitzvah in Israel, we stopped off in Rome, and standing at the Arch of Titus in the Forum, the most famous symbol of the destruction of Jerusalem, my son marked a siyum, the completion of an order of the Mishnah. Like the Ketubah of Castile, it was a remarkable moment that brought home to me the Jewish ability to rise from the ashes, and it was the Mishnah recited at the Arch, the Torah of Yavne, that is the true source of our endurance. It is a moment that I will not forget, and it brought home to me how much we owe this man through whom Judaism died, seemingly, but was reborn, and how every day we live as a Jew is ultimately due to what Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did and did not do.